Good afternoon and welcome to Focus. As I'm really excited to be here on the program today. Earlier this morning here at the WJR studios, I was able to recognize the sponsors of my show, School Talks, and I'm privileged to have some of them join me this afternoon to talk about some really important school topics that affect schools and whatnot. And our sponsor breakfast this morning was sponsored by the John Burke Agency, Mimic Insurance Company. And they did a nice job for us this morning, recognized our sponsors. And thanks to all the staff here at WJR for a really nice morning. But we're here now, we're down to business. And joining me in the studio is attorneys Gary Collins from Collins and Blaha and Don Denault from O'Reilly Rancilio. Welcome to the program, gentlemen.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you for having us.
So, as you know, we're in an election year, in case anyone didn't know that. And as a result of that, education always comes front and center. It seems like it has for many, many years. And this year being no different, part of what I wanted to explore with you today from really, I would consider them really opposite legal perspectives, but how they both affect what happens in the classroom. And the first one is, I'd like to start with you, Gary. Over the last decade or so, what happens in schools, how people are evaluated, often follows the political winds of who has the power in Lansing and so on. And I understand that we're now into a new or a revised evaluation system for both teachers and superintendents. Help our Focus listeners understand what that is and what it means right now.
Sure. We need to keep in mind that the evaluation systems were changed back in 2012 with the idea that we wanted to have more student growth as a factor in teacher evaluation. The problem is that student growth may be attributable to any number of factors, and partially including the teacher, but also partially due to external environments. And so over a period of time, it became fairly obvious that the student growth was not as important factor as people thought it was. And so they diminished the student growth factor in teachers to possibly, it could be down to zero, and to administrators to 20%. The impact of the student growth is it's measured against what the midpoint of the teachers that you're supervising are doing. So it's really never going to get to the point where you're going to be able to isolate a teacher or an administrator who is having poor student growth because the majority of their students or the majority of their people are going to be adequate.
I think an important clarification, when you say growth, that could be either within the school year?
Correct.
Or it could be from year to year?
Absolutely.
And as you know well, many public schools, many schools face the reality of kids sort of coming and going, depending on parents relocating.
Turnover rates.
Or the turnover rates are much, much different than they were long, long ago. And as a result of that, the notion of growth gets a little bit complicated in terms of whether it's within the school year or from year to year, because there's a fancy term in education called cohort.
Correct.
And that's a group of kids that hasn't changed. And in my time as superintendent, I knew well that when you study the cohort, that's probably a better indicator of how you're doing, because you're really managing the same group of children, whether it's within the year or from year to year. And let me ask you, the new evaluation system,
right,
independent of percentages, in your role working with school boards, how do you help the school boards who are responsible sort of walk through this process?
So when we designed a superintendent evaluation process that we walked through with the school boards, and we trained them on how to evaluate superintendents, we did that after looking at all the other states in the union that have superintendent evaluation systems, and then devising one for Michigan. And it is, once again, based on how do we help people advance in their position and how do we deal with policy and governance. And so it's been a successful model that we continue to use, and it's required now by the state that every school board be trained in superintendent evaluation.
And as we know well, the job of a teacher right now is really and truly the Lord's work. When you consider what's happening outside of schools with social media and all of the stuff that comes into schools, it is truly an extraordinary time. And I want to shift to you, Don. I you know, when you get out of the day-to-day business, you sometimes lose sort of what the word on the ground is on a day-to-day basis. And I really want you to share with our listeners something that has taken school children, or many of them, by storm. It's something called Kratom. Is that the right term?
That's the right term.
Tell us about Kratom and what it is and how it's affecting children right now. And I want the listeners to think about, as Don explains this, how it affects a teacher trying to do their job in a classroom. Go ahead.
Sure, thank you. First, I won't pretend to be an expert on what Kratom is. I'm a lawyer, so I look at it more from the standpoint of how it impacts our schools and how it impacts our cities and communities and what we can do as a state or a city to work with it or address it. Kratom is a substance now that is completely legal to purchase in Michigan. There are no regulations in terms of how it's designed, how it's bred, how it's produced, what it might be cut or laced with. And you can buy it at a lot of retail shops, gas stations, party-type stores, liquor-type stores. It is pretty readily available. And it's a substance that, as kids become more aware of it, they realize they don't have to go through or around any legal channels in order to get a hold of it. And it's a psychotropic type of substance, and it can be ingested in a number of different ways. And that substance then impacts and affects the kids, and it affects them in many of the same ways that maybe a marijuana might or some other type of scheduled drugs, some type of controlled substance. And it has a lot of different uses. It's a Southeast Asian plant that at low doses can have some medical benefits, but at higher doses can really impact kids.
And is this able to be purchased at like a gas station, like you buy vape? Is that?
It is. It is very much unregulated right now. And the state of Michigan has a bill pending to address that. The state of other states are looking at it. But what I'm finding is the cities and communities are getting ahead of it faster. And local communities, Spokane, Washington, for example, put together a great ordinance to address it, to basically ban it from being sold and or possessed by kids. Sold to or possessed by, because they know that it has effects that we have yet to study and really understand. And so for the moment, maybe keep it away from anyone under 21 until such time as we can better evaluate it.
And in your role working with school districts, are they starting to see it in the schools to where discipline's being issued and things like that?
Well, it would fall under any other school of code of conduct rules. Kids can't bring substances to school that aren't approved, other than maybe some medication type things. So, yes, it is starting to get into schools. It's starting to affect kids in school, and we're going to see more and more of that as they become more aware of it.
And, you know, when I think about the dichotomy of this conversation, Gary, we start out with the best way to evaluate teachers so kids learn as best they can, whether there's percentages involved in how we evaluate teachers. And then you have something really diametrically opposed to that in terms of what children are bringing in to schools. And when I think about a teacher who is faced with children who are coming to school under any number of situations and then are met with the challenges of being evaluated, it really, really and truly is a thankless a profession at times, and we owe an incredible debt of gratitude to the teachers and the staff who serve our children. This is Focus, and we'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the program. I'm excited to welcome Senior Vice President Janice Suchin from Clark Construction and from Wakely Associates Architects, owner Ron Syme. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So as we continue our school-focused conversation this morning, I wanted to have a conversation with you about the kinds of projects you're involved with. And, you know, one of the benefits of working here at the Fisher Building, you're so high up in the air, you can see all of the cranes around this building, which is obviously a sign that there's lots of construction going on right around us. And it really, really shines a great light on the things happening in the city. And Janice, I'd like to start with you. In your role as Senior Vice President, Clark Construction has done a wide range of projects in the city of Detroit, all kinds of things, schools, infrastructures, and that. And from your purview, how would you describe the overall role this kind of construction has played in this region's economic and sort of physical revitalization?
Sure. Yeah, I think everybody's pretty familiar with a lot of the activity that's been happening over the last decade in the business district and the sports and entertainment district. But what I'm really proud and happy to start seeing is some investment in healthcare and in the educational facilities in the city. We've been a proud partner with the Detroit Public School System, rebuilding a lot of the K-12 schools in the neighborhoods, which is fantastic. And then if you look around, I think we're up to nearly 12 higher education institutions that have a footprint in the city of Detroit, which is amazing. So we're bringing the education to the citizens of the city of Detroit, and we're a really proud partner of many of those, some developers, the University of Michigan and Wayne State University.
I think the word we use is synergy, right?
There you go.
You mentioned higher education institutions, and you know, when I was a kid, Michigan State was always in East Lansing, and
yes.
U of M was always in Ann Arbor. But the synergy that's happening down here is really incredible. Let me ask you, looking beyond any single project,
sure.
What are some of the important themes you see in Clark's work in Metro mm-hmm. Detroit? In any number of the projects, education or mixed use, what's a theme that drives your company?
I'd say there's two recent themes that I've seen recently. One is the communities in Southeast Michigan investing in and supporting K-12 education. The bond passage rate in the state and in the Midwest tends to be dipping a little bit, but in Southeast Michigan specifically, we still see a really nice bond passage rate and a really good evidence of communities supporting in investing in education, and it's resulting in higher performing, healthy schools for student success. The second theme that I've seen, which has been a surprise a bit, is kind of the rebooming or booming of community centers and recreation centers. It was pretty dormant for quite some time. Post-COVID, it seems like there's this desire from communities, again, to support those kind of projects, to pass bonds, to support them, and then to provide great facilities for communities to come together, to socialize, for kids to have recreational opportunities, mm-hmm. things to do outside of school. And right now we're working on two very innovative projects for the city of Pontiac as well as Eastern Washtenaw to provide some great facilities for those folks.
And as any great construction project goes, behind it is a really good architect. And Ron Syme, Wakely & Associates, how long have you been in business?
We're going to celebrate 75 years.
75 years. And it's fair to say that when you started, you were still using that onion skin paper and pencil.
Right. Right.
No computers, obviously,
no.
Right? So as a sponsor of School Talks, as well as Clark, I sincerely appreciate your continued support of our program, which runs on Sundays at 3 o'clock. But Ron, in your role at Wakely, what kinds of projects are you currently working on, especially in the education or public sector work?
We're working on several bond issues, and most of the bond issues we're working on right now is based on infrastructure upgrades. There's not a lot of curriculum upgrades at this point. Most of it is energy efficiency, roofs, things like that.
And when the term infrastructure, obviously a lot of that stuff isn't necessarily pretty, right?
No.
Tell us a bit, I remember this back in the day, when COVID was going on, there was obviously a really big concern about air quality.
Correct.
And as schools have had the opportunity to renovate and do things, tell us a bit about how they're focusing on air quality and HVAC type things.
Well, most of the HVAC that we're doing right now is completely brand new. So we're meeting the new energy codes, things like that, bringing a lot more fresh air in, creating a quality space for the students.
Mm-hmm.
So it's constant air changes, things like that.
And, you know, Janice, back to you for a minute. The kinds of work that you're doing, you mentioned a lot of Detroit Public School renovations.
Mm-hmm.
Any sense, are most of those renovating space, or are you tearing down and building new?
Combination of both throughout the district.
Combination of both.
Absolutely.
Because I've known, at least in my career as superintendent, sometimes it's actually cheaper and more efficient to tear it down and start over,
yes,
than to try to meet all the codes and things. And I know, Ron, in your role as an architect, it's a pretty tall order to take a building that hasn't been renovated in a long time.
Correct.
And bring it up to
the current codes and everything we can do to make it more modern and usable for today's student environment.
Following that, have you had, in your time doing architectural work, maybe in recent time, have you had the opportunity to use artificial intelligence?
Somewhat. I use it a lot myself for specification writing. If I'm trying to update specs based on new products or compare it to other products,
right,
I'll use that extensively. Sometimes we use it when we're modeling in BIM to complete and speed up the process.
And what's interesting, you know, there's a great fear out there right now that AI is going to replace everything.
Correct.
Justifiably in some sense. But it reminds me of the, I was probably the middle 1970s when my brother brought home a calculator. And my dad said, "You mean to tell me we don't have to carry the one anymore?" And that same reaction, it was really here when computers started and that. Mm-hmm. And I think many would agree that the future of AI is certainly unwritten in terms of where it ends up as part of our culture going, especially given how much it evolves. So in that line of thinking, Janice, I want to ask you, one of the things Clark prides itself on is taking care of its employees. I've known this for a long time. Tell me about the construction management field through your lens as a career opportunity right now, and more importantly, how has that profession evolved?
Absolutely. So I actually, I'm an architect, and I switched professions and moved into construction management 6 years ago. It's a great profession. Jobs are still in demand. I think almost every construction management company in Southeast Michigan is still growing, still hiring. If management is your skill set, it's a great, great field to go into. There is shortage, though, for sure. So what we're doing at Clark is we're trying to build that talent from within. We've got a lot of internal training programs, apprenticeship opportunities, and we're also working with high school students. So back to the education, we're building awareness of the architecture, construction, and engineering fields at the high school level through the ACE mentorship program and trying to get them down this path with scholarships as soon as we can.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you shine a really important light on the future. With all these cranes around us here at the Fisher Building, I don't know, we need to have a sign that says we need help, but and I know schools are doing their part to help kids be prepared in those career and tech fields. So Ron Syme from Wakely & Associates Architects and Janice Suchin from Clark Construction, two really important sponsors of my show School Talks. I appreciate you stopping by Focus this afternoon, and it doesn't even need to be said, but keep up the great work. We'll be back right after this.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the program. Joining us now is Paul Wills, a partner from Plant Moran Real Point, another really important sponsor of my show, School Talks. Paul and I had the opportunity at our sponsor breakfast this morning to talk a bit about the kinds of work they're doing in and around the city. It's quite frankly staggering, but I do want to take a minute and mention our breakfast this morning was right here at the Fisher Building, where I had an opportunity to thank all of my sponsors for their continued support of School Talks. We continue to do good work, and the breakfast this morning was sponsored by the John Burke Agency Insurance, who assists educators in applying for grants and prizes for classrooms, all kinds of things. So if you need any kind of insurance, give the John Burke Agency a call, and they can certainly help you out. And I actually think they also can sell Progressive and like AAA insurance and that. So John Burke Agency, a big support of our breakfast here this morning here high atop the Fisher Building. So we're back to you, Paul. Welcome to the program.
Dr. Livernois, always a pleasure to be here with you.
So I've worked and known Plant Moran Real Point for a very long time. And I think given, as I said earlier in the program, all the work that's surrounding us here in the Fisher Building, it's a really neat opportunity for us to know the kind of work that Plant Moran Real Point does. And let me start with this. What would you consider is the core mission of your firm and how it helps you approach all of these projects that you're involved with in Michigan?
That's a great question. So obviously Plant Moran, we just celebrated our 100-year anniversary in from 1924. So in 2024, really what we want to become is really our client's trusted advisor. And so if it's real estate, if it's capital programs, we want to be able to provide an end-to-end comprehensive service to them to allow them to focus on their core jobs. So if it's in the public sector, if it's in healthcare, corporate, or development mixed use, again, we just really become an extension of their staff, really allowing them to focus on their core missions. So.
And as the term owner's rep goes, you actually represent the owner. And in my case as a superintendent, you were the representative for the Board of Education, and you're responsible for leading the entire project. Help our listeners understand, what are some of the groups or firms that you manage as an owner's rep? Just give us a sense of that.
Absolutely. So great example. From come off your sponsors today. I work with a lot with Wakely Associates as the architectural firms, engineering firms. I do a lot of work with our clients. Same thing with Clark Construction. So As an owner's agent or owner's representative, you know, we become that extension of their staff for facilities and finance. So typically any construction project, about 70% is going to be construction related. And the other 30% is more of those owner costs. So technology, furniture, move management, really tracking the budgets. So that's how we ultimately become that trusted advisor overseeing the entire program.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, for our listeners here on Focus, a school district has so much to deal with away from the technicalities of what you just mentioned. It makes such good sense to have someone represent you. You know, our business is educating kids and getting them to and from school. It certainly isn't what type of HVAC system to install, whatever it is. So the role of an owner's rep, which your company has done extraordinarily well for a long time, is really important. And following that thought, can you give us a big picture view right now? I understand you're working with Detroit Public Schools Community District and how your work right now ties into their facilities improvement plan.
Great question. Actually, I've been honored, and our firm's been honored to work with Detroit Public Schools really since 2009 on their first $500 million bond program. And on that success, came through with the additional $700 million to really create new educational spaces for students across the board. I'm looking at preservation, some of the historical buildings, but more importantly, just becoming that extension, because as you can imagine with a $700 million program, we have a multitude of architects, a multitude of construction managers, and our job is really to make sure that our clients are making informed decisions. And mm-hmm. so in this case, they don't get any more money. So it's a $700 million program, and they're reinvesting into new facilities as well as renovating it. And it's really just to keep them on task, on schedule, and most importantly, keep them informed.
You bring me to a thought. When I was superintendent, one of the biggest pressures is to make sure that all the work that gets done in the summer is done so school can open in the fall. Many people don't connect the fact that it's tough to do renovation work in a school when school is in session, right? You can only do certain things after hours, like pull some cable or whatnot, but the heavy lift of renovating a school happens quite often in, what, 10, 11 weeks?
Correct.
And when I think, I can remember this well, early August was always an interesting time for me to start raising the question of, are we going to be able to open on time? And I can't tell you how many times Plant Moran Real Point made me look good as a superintendent, because we always opened on time at or under budget. And it's remarkable when you think about all the moving parts that you just sort of detailed. Let me move away from schools for a minute. I understand you're working at Huntington Place. You're overseeing a pretty big program there. And a perfect example, how are you balancing the need to sort of keep the center, convention center open while you're doing the modernization work? Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's been a very interesting project, as you know, with the Huntington Place, which is part of the Cobo Hall renovations, if you will. obviously, we always have a saying that says, you know, plan the work and then work the plan. And so having multiple owners in this case with multiple authorities, the mayor's office, et cetera, really working with the contractors and the designers. So a great mm-hmm. example is the 2nd Street Bridge extension. You know, we had to work with MDOT. We had to work with the federal because we're putting a bridge over the Northwestern Lodge Freeway extension.
Right, right.
So how do you keep a freeway open? So again, a lot of that just takes a lot of that planning, a lot of due diligence.
Mm-hmm.
Also making sure that you're looking at alternatives for different deliveries to make sure that the owner's making informed decisions, mm-hmm. but more importantly, that they're on schedule and on budget and trying to minimize those impacts. So we've been very successful working.
It's funny you mentioned 2nd Street, because the 2nd Street dead ends right here at the Boulevard, and we can look out this window right now down the street and see the bridge
see
that
the
you're
cranes,
talking about.
Right, exactly.
It's a remarkable. Let me ask you, on the other side of the Fisher Building, you're working with Henry Ford Hospital. Tell us about that. That's a really big, I guess the term would be campus transformation. Is that the term?
That is correct.
Tell us about that, because that's one of those things I continue to mention you can see. Tell us about that. What's going on there?
Yeah, so with the Henry Ford, you know, Future of Health, obviously is the $3.3 billion campus transformation. It's multiple towers, multiple facilities. It's a lot of utility work, which has been great. And so at the end of the day, you know, we're really acting as that development coordinator. And at the end of the day, it's one of those things that we've taken a look of looking at the feasibility, yeah. the planning and stuff, just make sure it stays on budget. It's great to see the progress, too.
Yeah. Plant Moran Real Point, Paul Wills, thanks for joining us on Focus. And stay right there. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the program. I am delighted to have on the show with us today Dr. Christian Greer, the CEO of the Michigan Science Center. Welcome to the program, Doctor.
It's good to be here.
We can finally get down to some school stuff.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely.
So some of our listeners might be aware about the new planetarium that has been reopened at the center, but I'd like you to give our listeners a really good sense of the newly dedicated Penske Planetarium at the Science Center and how Penske's foundation's gift really help transform the whole thing, because it is remarkable.
Yes, it's a great question, and it's something we're very excited about. As a matter of fact, when the organization sort of restarted as the Michigan Science Center in 2012, as a new 501c3, it was in debt, lots of challenges, and my board chair, Tom Stevens, reached out to Roger Penske to get some support. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, it's one thing when you have a challenging situation, you're trying to do something that's mission-based, and somebody, when you're down and challenged, comes through for you in a big way, makes all the difference in the world. And here we are now in 2026, being able to dedicate the planetarium by the Penske Foundation is really exciting, because we have this incredible 8K projection system that allows us to be able to show the most incredible scenes from space, and they are all data-driven by NASA data and other research scientists and astrophysicists that collect data. We can project it right on the dome. We have 5.1 sound. We have great new seats. We have a nanoseam dome. It's an exciting time to be in the planetarium world with Penske Planetarium.
I had the good fortune of going to the planetarium soon after it opened with my wife and some of my children. And one of the neatest things is how you actually start like you're in the city of Detroit.
Yes, yes.
And you go from there to wherever. You know, a long way away, and it really helps you. It's sort of a grounding effect as to where we are and just how vast that is.
Oh, absolutely. And it's one of those things that, you know, perhaps we should have spent more time thinking about deep space and all the renderings that we had to do for that. But that was the one thing we started with. We wanted a really good scene from Detroit to be able to, like, take off from this area, something familiar, and go to places unfamiliar, as far away even with our show, which was called Hyperspace, A Stellar Odyssey, presented by Stellantis. That show allowed us to go to our closest, nearest galaxy, large galaxy in space, like the Milky Way, called Andromeda. And it was just an awesome thing.
And it really is, it feels real life, even though it's tough to conceptualize the I don't know if it's 3 or 4D, whatever the dome is, puts you in a totally different space, no pun intended.
Yeah, absolutely.
then, you know, when I watched film strips as a kid mm-hmm. in elementary school. And I think there's an old saying, timing is everything.
It is.
And as we sit today, Artemis, this space, the lunar mission, is currently on its way back. And I'm curious what opportunity that's provided you at the center, given it launched, I believe, on April 1st. Could you walk our listeners through what that mission is all about and some of the high points of it that you've been able to follow?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as a kid, you mentioned the film strips. I remember doing that, too. I had to load the, I guess it was like the 8mm film strip in there to watch lots of different things. I was born in 1969, not out of the womb yet to be able to see the moon landing in July, but I grew up really fascinated by this idea that you could go up into space. And this is what we're trying to do right now. And this Artemis II mission is so perfect for 2026 with America's 250th. Mm-hmm. You know, as a way to celebrate, you know, the country's ability, capability, daring, innovation, all those things are so exciting. And this mission is the second mission. Now, I had a chance to see Artemis 1. I happened to be in Orlando, and while I was getting ready to go to a meeting or something, I saw it on TV, and I'd forgotten that the launch for Artemis 1 had been delayed because of a hydrogen leak. And they finally launched it on the day that I was down there. I was like, I got to go see this. And so in the middle of the night, I took an Uber all the way from Orlando to Titusville, which was very expensive, but it was 100% worth it. It was my first rocket launch. And to see a moon rocket as the first one, everything else seems sort of basic from here. But it was loud. And I remember when it took off, it was like the plumes of gas coming out of the bottom of the rocket, going up into space, like lit up the night sky. Giant fireball. And I remember someone standing next to me who was like, oh, my God, oh, my God, they did it. They did it. So for all of you engineers out there who make things happen, this is them doing it. and doing it in a big way. And it's really exciting. So this mission is really about the human side of it. And a Michigander who's one of the astronauts, Christina Cook, is responsible as a mission specialist for all of the things that take place associated with life support, including the toilet. So it's an exciting time for us to see them do their thing.
So all of the seventh graders out there who aren't listening right now because they're probably in school, when you ask that question about geometry or physics, when am I ever going to use this?
This is it.
It's right here.
And apply it to just watching on television is really what having those STEM goggles on and seeing what you can see and learn what you can learn.
You know, someone asked me not long ago, why are they not landing on the moon? And, you know, there was so much success and attention given to the Apollo mission that landed on the moon. Help our listeners understand at least that purpose of the mission was not necessarily to land, but to do other things.
That's correct. And for the Apollo mission, I believe they were listed by letters at the time. So Apollo 11, I believe, was a G mission, and that was the one that they wanted to be able to land at that point. Mm-hmm. And then all subsequent missions were supposed to do other things. You know, the first one, 11, was to land. Apollo 12, they wanted a pinpoint landing. Apollo 13, they were going to do something else. Fra Mauro, another place on the moon. So all these things are sort of like stages, one step, two steps, three steps. Learning about the SLS launch vehicle, the stack that goes up, a little shorter than the Saturn V, but much more powerful and like 15% more power and thrust. But this mission, to me, the landing is scheduled to be Artemis 3 or 4. That is pretty impressive. I mean, we haven't even done a spacewalk yet in the Orion capsule, which is called Integrity. The astronaut crew names that. So that's one thing that I think we'll just have to see how well they can get that. But now with so many simulations that you have and things that you can do with AI, there's a lot that can simulate on the ground. So it makes it a lot easier and safer to be able to handle the astronauts out in space.
One of the most intriguing parts of this mission, and I've been a pretty good student of it since it started, lots of people have an understanding of the space station that's out there. Many of us remember how the space shuttle would orbit the Earth.
Oh, absolutely. So I saw that with my very own eyes go over the sky. Yeah.
And most of those objects orbit somewhere between 100 and 300 miles above the Earth.
Yeah.
How far away is this mission to the moon, roughly?
Well, the average distance to the moon is about 238,000 miles away from the Earth. Meaning it varies because it's not a completely circular orbit. As Einstein sort of predicted in relativity that the orbits would precess and Kepler described them as elliptical. So there's sometimes in which the moon is closer, sometimes further away. You see this during eclipses. In this case, they're greater than 245,000 miles away from the Earth. And this is the furthest that anybody's ever traveled. Apollo 11 went pretty far out while they were there. Apollo 8 as well. Mm-hmm. But Apollo 13 may have been the furthest. And so to be that far out is really interesting. It's considered deep space. It's not deep space like Uranus or Neptune. Yeah. But for us, in terms of humans going out into space, it's pretty far out.
And when you think about all of the fanfare in the old-fashioned, if that's even a term, old-fashioned shuttle launches.
Exactly.
You mentioned plumes of smoke.
It's incredible.
And how much thrust it took to get that off the ground.
A lot.
But only to go a couple hundred miles?
Yeah, it's incredible to think about how much has to be ejected and how much fuel. I mean, these things weigh a lot. So when they first take off the ground, they go slow. Then they start accelerating. And part of that is they lose mass, and then they can really get going.
Yeah, and in this case, once they're out in orbit on their way to the moon, they're doing what, 1,500 miles an hour?
Yeah, and as they come in tomorrow, they'll be at 25,000 miles per hour when they hit the atmosphere. So that's the part we really want to worry about. Hopefully, they come home safely with the heat shield and everything is good. The splashdown in near San Diego in the Pacific, and we can celebrate.
I'm looking forward to it. Dr. Christian Greer, CEO of the Michigan Science Center, thanks for stopping by, helping us learn a little more about Artemis, and congratulations on the planetarium. And as always, keep up the good work.
Thank you.
This is Focus. Paul W. Smith will be back right after this. Welcome back to the program. I'm delighted to have with us former U.S. Congressman Dan Kildee. Welcome to the program, Dan.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So as many of our listeners may know, you spent some time in the U.S. House, I think 2013 to 2025. But more importantly, you are now the co-founder of the Center for Community Progress, and you actually helped create Michigan's first land bank in Genesee County to support Flint's redevelopment. So life after the U.S. Congress for Dan Kildee. You're now serving, I also understand you're at Central Michigan and you're leading the Community Foundation. And I'm curious, given your support of the town in which you grew up, how do these two things, Central and the foundation, sort of complement each other?
Well, they really do. And in a way, like all those roles that I've played over the years, I feel like I've never actually changed jobs. I get different business cards and they put a different toolbox in front of me, but it's like the same work. It's all about trying to breathe life into my hometown. The work at CMU and at the Community Foundation, they do align in one really important sense, is that in both cases, part of my mission is to get more people engaged in civic leadership. We call it civic health, but it's really about getting people to feel a connection to their, you know, their neighbors and exercise some kind of civic engagement, some kind of civic leadership, and create stronger connections between people with the belief when we have a stronger sense of community, our ability to solve the community problems we face is so much greater. Mm-hmm. So at CMU, I'm trying to train young minds to exercise leadership by giving them the tools that they need and the understanding of our civic institutions in order to apply whatever interests they have. And at the Community Foundation, it's similar, only in this case, we're reaching into the neighborhoods, trying to get people who are quietly exercising civic leadership to see one another, to connect with one another, and then to get them the skills that they need to be even more effective in doing that work. It's really, to me, that's the central focus of my work here at the Community Foundation. And as you say, it aligns very closely with what I'm doing at Central Michigan University.
And in your role at Central Michigan, you are the Griffin Chair for that department. And I'm curious,
right,
with the work you do with the students, do you have them do any kind of projects in the community that help them develop the leadership that you're pointing to?
We do. I teach a fall course and a spring course. One is more on politics and sort of political activism. The other is really about policy. Right now, my students, for example, they're all involved in their capstone projects for the semester. And that is to look at a community problem and then try to devise a strategy to address it. Like, what policy changes might they make if they could wave their magic wand to deal with what they view as a serious community problem that needs a solution that would involve governmental policy. So it's sort of get the muscle memory going to figure out how to actually problem solve. A lot of folks are good at identifying problems, and I'm sure in your career, particularly as a school superintendent, you had no lack of people who were willing to share with you what the problem is. But it's folks who are willing to say, and I have an idea to solve it. And that's what we're trying to do with these projects that I've got the students working on.
We had an old saying in education, we're really good at starting things. But the challenge for us, and I would tell my staff this all the time, when things happen that you didn't like in terms of test scores or whatnot, I would continually remind them that the only way out of this is to teach our way out of this.
Yeah,
and exactly. In your example, within the community, you know, looking back at your time in Congress, what accomplishment are you most proud of for Flint and, say, Genesee County as a whole?
Well, probably this biggest single accomplishment was one that I would have preferred not to have to deal with, and that was at the peak of the Flint water crisis when the community was really flat on its back because of what took place here. I'm sure your listeners are quite familiar with what happened there. I've been on the air on WJR talking about it for many years. But at the peak of that crisis, every level of government was going to be required to help solve this problem. And I was able in the House of Representatives, working with my Senate colleagues, to get assistance for the city of Flint through the House of Representatives. And, you know, frankly, at a time when it was difficult to get anything through the House, we were able to get a package that consisted of $170 million to help solve this problem in Flint. And I had bipartisan support for that effort. I needed to have bipartisan support for it. So, you know, even there are other things that I'm proud of that I've done, that particular moment was one where I knew I needed to deliver for my hometown. And the fact that we were able to get that done, you know, with my colleagues, with Senator Stabenow and Senator Peters working it hard on the other side of the building back when Senator Stabenow was still there, we were able to get it done, and I'm very proud of that.
Speaking of getting it done, I don't know that there's anything more important than having quality water, as you've experienced that up there. You know, in your work at the Community Foundation, as it sits right now, what would you identify as one of the biggest needs Greater Flint has right now that you're hoping to address?
Well, I think it's a couple of items that are connected. One is just improving the quality of life for the residents in the community. And that starts with working at the block level. We had a summit just a few weeks ago, our Connect the Blocks Neighborhood Summit, to engage neighbors and listen to them to try to figure out, well, what are the things that we need in our neighborhoods to improve the quality of life? But I don't think anybody would deny the fact that the biggest challenge that we face in the state, and that's especially true in my region, is to get access to better paying jobs, to have an economy that, you know, that provides a wage that allows people to, you know, to do the things that they want to do to raise their families, to put something aside for the future, to have a decent house to live in, to be able to take a vacation once in a while, and to be able to get your kids the opportunity that our parents and grandparents gave to us. So it's really focusing on place and on making sure the quality of our neighborhoods is as good as it can be, all toward the goal of building an economy that's more sustainable.
And let me say, what you say is good for Flint in that description really is good anywhere when you consider, for example, the students you're teaching at Central, helping them see that they're actually part of the solution in the communities that they live. So often, as you know well in your time in Congress, so often many people think that whatever's going to happen is going to happen from somewhere else, when the fact is it's really in the mirror looking right at you.
And 100%.
And the kind of work that you're doing is laudable, the foundation work and all of the experiences that you've had in Congress and bringing that back home to Flint. So former U.S. Congressman Dan Kildee and now Griffin Chair at Central Michigan, thanks for stopping by Focus with Paul W. Smith. Welcome back to the program. I am delighted to have with us on the program Dr. Glenn Maleko, the brand new state superintendent for public education here in Michigan. Welcome to the program, doctor.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Livernois. Very excited to be here and always grateful to you. When I was learning to be a local superintendent years ago, you provided me with some outstanding training and support, so I have the highest respect for you. So thank you for allowing me to come on the show.
I appreciate your kind words, and by all accounts, from what I've seen, you are off to a fabulous start. And I think a good place for us to start today would be your transition into this role, having been the superintendent in Dearborn Public Schools for a long time. How has your transition looked over the past several months, and what are the first priorities you're setting for the department since you've been there?
Yeah, I appreciate that. To be honest, I'm having a lot of fun on the job. It doesn't mean there's some little stress here and there when you're dealing with the whole state and working together to improve student outcomes. But, you know, my biggest learning has really been at the state government and local level, across the state and just learning the inner workings. But there's some great people at the Michigan Department of Education that have provided me with support, Dr. Sue Carnell, Bob Wheaton, my core team. So I'm learning state, and I'm excited to do that. There is a tremendous amount of things that I have to approve on a daily basis. That's one of the things that I wasn't aware was going to happen, but it's been exciting. And the other thing I can say is, you know, spending 30 years in Dearborn, starting out as a teacher, you know, working through as a principal, up to HR, and then superintendent for 10 years, that local experience has been invaluable to me. So I miss my good friends in Dearborn, but I'm actually very, very excited to do the work here at the state level. And you asked about top priorities. I mean, it's literacy. Very excited that we're working on legislation that was also passed prior to me, the literacy and dyslexia law, to require, you know, high quality training for teachers and also to provide high curriculum material. The governor has been a big support, working collaboratively with the MyLEAP, which is in charge of early childhood and, post-secondary opportunities for students. We've been working together. We've been working with educational associations, the legislature. I believe heavily, Dr. Livernois, in collaboration and working together. I'm a diehard Detroit Red Wing fan, a hockey guy, sports guy. Go Blue, by the way. Congratulations to them. And hopefully this weekend with the Frozen Four, that they're doing well. But I believe in don't body check your own team. We're all on the same team about students. So whether it's, you know, I want to work with Republicans, Democrats, the legislature, the governor, parents, anyone that wants to help students, that's who I want to work with. So that's been really during my transition, that's been a huge focus, and it will continue to be, you know, moving forward.
Given the diversity of the state with regard to the size of districts where students are concentrated, that approach makes a ton of sense in terms of connecting the whole state. And I applaud you for recognizing that diversity. And if anyone is following you on social media, they know that you travel with a banner. It's called Students First. And it's really become a visible symbol of your leadership. In fact, I think you brought it from Dearborn Schools. And I'm curious, although it is a banner, how do you define what Students First actually means in practice? And how do you ensure it doesn't become just a slogan?
Yeah, I truly believe in it. Going back to my time in Dearborn, when we started this in 2016, and I lived it. I lived it because I believe that student voice was critical. I had a superintendent student advisory committee. And what I said to the board back in Dearborn is when we make decisions, and the community rallied around it, was that we need to focus on what is going to be in the best interest of students. We know we have to manage politics, and I learned that as a local superintendent. But the bottom line is, how are students going to benefit? And again, I come back to, it's a rallying point too, because I used to love it when I was in the schools and the students knew who I was because of social media. And then they would want to approach me. It was an easy icebreaker. I mean, we can get, you know, Republicans and Democrats and educational leaders behind this. And we have to really believe it. When I interviewed before the state board, last August, I pulled out the Dearborn in my first interview and I said, look, if you hire me, I believe this is important. The second interview, I created this new sign that wasn't official at the time. Now we've made it official. And, you know, Dr. Livernois, as I've been traveling the state, it has been valuable for me because I came from Dearborn, a larger district, you know, urban, suburban district. I had to get out in the rural communities as well. And I'm bringing the banner, and it really is working. It's promoting a message. Now we have to do the work to improve student outcomes, but everyone is rallying behind it. We're looking at potentially renewing the top 10 strategic education plan. I think we have a solid plan, but we're looking at moving forward and bringing stakeholders together. And I can tell you that Students First model will be part of it. I do live and breathe it. And, you know, students have helped me with a lot of things. When I was in Dearborn, you know, we changed our food service model because of them, our strategic plan. And they've taught me how to use social media. You mentioned social media. So I learned from them. It's where do you go? You need to learn from them. And so we actually adopted it wasn't official, but my first day on the job, I told Mr. Wheaton from our Michigan department that we need to approve the sign, and we did, and we brought it in, and now board members want it. It's getting out there, and it's just a positive feel, right? But we do have to do the work. It's not just bringing a sign around. It's working behind it and improving outcomes for students and making a difference for all Michigan students.
And I think it's worth noting, during your decade as superintendent in Dearborn, and I want the listeners to focus on this, your district achieved a graduation rate above 95%. On top of that, earned multiple Blue Ribbon School Awards back in the day. 95% of the students in Dearborn graduate from high school. And that is, it's no secret that you're in the position you're in now. And I'm curious, in this first few months for you, what are some of the strategies that worked in Dearborn do you think are going to translate well at the state level?
Yeah, I mean, I bring that experience with me, and I did branch out a little because I was president of the Michigan Superintendent Association on the National Association Board. So I had a lot of broad ideas that I saw and was exposed to. But a few of the things that I think made a big difference with that is one was a graduation intervention model. You know, we moved graduation rates, as you recognize. I mean, we were in the 70s percent many years ago, and we moved on it. And what it was is providing additional support for students and identifying students that were off track from graduation early on and meeting their needs by communicating with them and getting them back on track. Other things, we had a very large English language learner population in Dearborn, and we had a state and national model for what we were doing with literacy and literacy coaching models, which I think were very important. And another important piece I would just say is post-secondary education opportunities. We had a huge partnership with Henry Ford College. We had about 3,800 students that were taking dual enrollment classes every year. This was our early college program, our collegiate academy, and just dual enrollment classes, and then the number of students that were taking the AP exam. And so that was achieving at a higher level. We estimated that we were saving parents on average every year $20 million. So that led to not only a 95% graduation rate, but a 73% college admission rate. These are the things I want to bring to the state with expansion in these areas, which I think are very, very important. So I bring that model. The other thing is just, and I've had it in my legislative priorities, Dr. Livernois, is equity funding, we call it, for those students that are English language learners, those that are below the poverty. I've looked at other high achieving states, and they've all funded at high levels these areas. And I think it's very important. And we should point out that we should be proud that Michigan has hit an all-time high graduation rate of 84%. Mm-hmm. So although improvements are still needed, we know that, we have progress that we're making together.
Absolutely. Dr. Glenn Maleko, State Superintendent of Public Education, as always, keep up the great work. I'm proud of the work you're doing, and I'm looking forward to what lies ahead. And thanks for joining us on Focus.
Thank you, Dr. Livernois. I appreciate it.
We'll be back right after this. Good afternoon. Welcome to the program. I'm delighted to have join us Professor Rachel Cole, Wayne State University law professor, where she teaches a variety of courses in the law school. And part of her specialization involves civil rights, labor, and employment law. Welcome to the program, Professor.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So thank you. One of the things that intrigued me about having you join me on the program is not long ago, I read some press release from Wayne State about the work you're doing as it relates to artificial intelligence and its effect on labor. And I think a good place, this is certainly a hot topic right now in industry. And I'm curious, in your role, what patterns are you seeing in the kinds of jobs that AI is already changing or starting to replace versus those that are becoming more valuable?
Yeah, so I think the biggest area where we're seeing possible replacement at some point are jobs that have more singular nature focuses. So, for example, driving. Jobs that involved only driving, like taxis, Lyfts, and Ubers. We might see some actual specific rocks to that particular labor market sooner. In San Francisco, they already have autonomous vehicles that you can take instead of a Lyft or an Uber. And I actually took one when I was there a few weeks ago for a conference. And, you know, it took some wonky turns and it dropped me off about three blocks from where I wanted to be. But, you know, it got me pretty close. And so there are going to be some shifts for some markets for sure. I think where people are going to be the most valuable is where there's going to be knowledge to be able to know what the AI is doing and if it's doing it correctly or incorrectly, because that is the biggest problem with AI is that it can be wrong. It can make things up. It can pull from outdated information. And so people with actual knowledge about what is going on in their role are needed more than ever, even in the age of AI.
And in your research, I understand you've written about access and inclusion in technology. And how do you see AI affecting different workers in the workforce in terms of their access to things? Because using AI makes the assumption that you have access to a computer, you know, all those kinds of things, presumably. But I'm curious how you see it overall affecting the workforce.
Yeah, so I think there's a couple different things here. I mean, one of the things that AI is really good at is being able to pull a lot of information and look for patterns in data. And we could use AI for good if we try to really look at where our systemic disparities are and try to come up with better solutions, and we could use AI to help us do that. But I think where more of the reality exists is that if we have this over-dependence on AI, it could have a wide scale effect. So one of the things that you mentioned my writing, and so I really reviewed the cautionary tale that what happened in Michigan in 2013 when the Unemployment Insurance Agency of Michigan implemented an automated system to make decisions about every single claim that went through the system without any human oversight. The state laid off people that actually knew the nuances of unemployment insurance law and let this computer system run rampant without any human oversight for years. And then only after enough complaints to legislators happened did they do an actual oversight of this program. And they realized that the computer was making incorrect decisions, denying people benefits, and charging them with fraud at a 95% error rate. It's astronomical, right? And that's one of the difficulties that AI has is that it's a much bigger scaled problem than if one human is making a mistake versus if AI is making a mistake, because it can apply to every single decision. And so that's where I see why we need more oversight in particular, but it can further exacerbate problems that already exist, especially if we're using things that are encoded with our already existing biases.
You raise a really interesting point. And as you know, some people talk about job loss panic over AI. And the way you frame that explanation of the insurance, someone on the ground, a human with institutional history of an organization, is a completely different asset to the company than a computer that can retrieve information. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And I think that that's the only way AI can work well is if you have people in roles that know what they're doing.
And more importantly, how to use AI maybe to enhance what they're doing.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, early on when science became sci-fi and television and that, there was always the old-fashioned movies where the aliens or the robots are taking over the world and so on and so forth. And personally, I just don't see it as it becoming that, but rather something that can be truly be a supplement. And if you had your way, how should policymakers and employers be preparing for the kinds of skills workers will need, say, in the next 5 years?
Yeah, so I think the biggest thing policymakers, I mean, there's a couple different fronts that policymakers really need to think about. But as far as the labor market is concerned, where there needs to be human oversight in these programs, basically, if AI is acting as a decision maker in any way, shape, or form, whether that's in government benefits and any other types of public decisions that might be happening, or if it's even in private employment decisions, any decision-making process that a computer is doing, it absolutely needs to have strong provisions as well as a requirement for human review. Without that, we risk the astronomical consequences that we saw with Michigan and the Unemployment Insurance Agency.
In my show, School Talks, we regularly have guests on who talk about life after high school, what opportunities there are for students, whether it's college, workforce, entering the armed forces, whatever skilled trades. And one of the things that has become even more and more a focus of our conversation is I'm a student graduating high school. So what should I expect AI to do to a field that I want to study? What advice would you give to a graduating senior as to the effect AI might have on their interests?
Well, I think you should still follow your interests. I think that AI is a tool that we can use, but we still need people that know what they're doing in these roles and can become those expertise, have that expertise that's needed for the role, regardless of if it is, whatever sector that it's in. And so I would say still follow your interests, but really remember that the biggest thing that we have as humans is the ability to think. And so don't rely on AI. I see this with my students all the time. I don't want them just to rely on AI to do the thinking for them. They need to be the ones that can think, because that's the only way we can test AI. Yeah.
Professor Rachel Cole from Wayne State University, thanks for a great conversation, and keep up the good work there at the university. And this is Focus, and we'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the program. I am delighted to have a really neat guest with us here to close out today's program, Robert Brengman, who is way up in Traverse City and is part of Brengman Family Wines. Welcome to the program, Robert.
Thanks, Dr. Livinois. Glad to be here.
So I have to ask first, before we get started, do you have any idea how much snow totally you got this winter?
Oh, man, that was a good winter for snow. I typically get my exercise by skiing around the vineyard, and I have plenty of that this year. Because, yeah, the two previous seasons, we didn't have much, but yeah. This was good. I don't know, maybe 170 inches, something like that.
Wow. So in my research on Brengman Family Wines, I wanted to chat with you because your history and how you ended up where you are now is really intriguing. And it is really a success story sort of grown out of the city of Detroit down here. So help us understand, what are the origins of Brengman Family Wines?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm really the guilty one who started all this. It was me. I planted the seed and got others from the family interested. Our history, of course, is the Detroit area, the East Siders. We were probably the kids that were driving our bikes, through Grosse Pointe to get to the lake to fish every morning and in the summer. But I was able to do that and introduced the business. The hospitality business was introduced to us, from our family, really. And I was the creative one who attended CCS, Center for Creative Studies, and found design work up in Traverse City in 1989. So I was a wine collector even in my early ages because of the family background in the restaurant business. And while traveling the country, I would collect wines and very interested in it. But around 2000, an uncle came up and started a vineyard project on Old Mission. And our 8-year-old and I volunteered to help Uncle Tom plant his first block of Riesling. And I learned a lot that day. I was looking at some point in my life, I wanted a career. I wanted to try it. I always thought farming and making wine was something that I would be really good at. And after that day, we started our Crane Hill Vineyard in 2003 in Leland All Peninsula.
And from growing grapes, and I would imagine around 2003, you start growing grapes. It takes a little time to have a crop, and to the point where you're then producing wines by, I think it was 2010. In that process, we talked a bit about the weather. I'm curious, given your experience through this, what are and continue to be some of the biggest challenges in winemaking and really being part of that bigger Leelanau wine scene?
Yeah, I mean, what is the saying? You have to experience failure before you can experience success, and I think that's something that we had here. I mean, a challenge is failures for sure. In the early years, our focus was, what was our end game and how do we get there? And we were smart enough to study the types of wine growing and winemaking models that were out there. And we wanted to establish a sustainable farming program and with an estate winemaking program. Hmm. That means that we would eventually need to invest in the type of equipment, winemaking equipment, that would support our processing. So first it made sense, to experience a few harvests and see how the wines were responding to the terroir that we picked. And as history goes, we sold our grapes for the first three harvests. And that took, like you said, Robert, 3 years after we planted. And then took our grapes to a custom crush facility the next 2 years. And then in 2010, we started, in 2012, actually, we started the estate wine.
So you mentioned sustainability. Give our listeners a sense, maybe one or two things that you mean when you say sustainable farming.
Yeah, I mean, our goal is to cut back on the synthetic chemicals. And in order to do that, you try to eliminate, some of the poisons like weed control. And one year, for a while there, we had sheep out in the vineyard to help us control the, you know, the growth. If there was money in weeds, we'd be damn rich here. But it's, you know, it's something like getting that. We had guinea hens a few years to help us with the insects. You know, it's being creative and trying to figure out ways that would eliminate some of the some of the chemicals.
So I understand, along with your brother Ed, who's up there working the winery with you, I understand you recently rebranded from Brengman Brothers to Brengman Family Wines. And I'm curious, what was the idea behind that, and how does that reflect the growth beyond just you and Ed as the future lay ahead?
Yeah, I mean, good question. You know, mainly because we changed it because, the brothers are getting older, you know, and we see that, you know, that it's time to pass the baton, really. It's coming up. And you know, our passion, we started it with the brothers, but, you know, it's fermented into a devoted and amazing staff, blood and not blood, you know, and including family in the title kind of made it better for our future. That's, and we agreed, and then we said, let's make that change.
You know, at the front of this, you mentioned coming from a family of hospitality. Your grandparents, Peter and Augusta Brengman, were really icons. I think they were part of the Continental Bowl and all the captain's restaurants that were down on the east side. And to hear you say that some of your family is in there with you now that drove the renaming to Brengman Family Wines certainly makes sense, just given the need to pass the torch along. And I'm curious, one last thought, if you could, for listeners maybe dreaming of starting their own winery, what is a key lesson or two that you've learned in your time up there in Traverse City?
Yeah, it's do your homework and find your lane. The wine industry is an ancient art, right? And form of commerce. And some say it's morphing all the time. And, you know, and we believe in our lane, right? Premium wine made using the slow process. Right. We're not using the conventional wine process. We're using natural yeast and working more so, you know, in some of the old world style. So we expect our wines to be in, you know, just in someone's fridge, kitchen, or cellar, you know.
Sure.
So, you know, that's what we're doing. And our lane, yeah, I think you got to pick your lane and you follow the changes. I like the lifestyle here and enjoying the setting for sure.
Yeah. Robert Brengman from Brengman Family Wines, thanks so much for joining us on Focus this afternoon. Keep up the good work up there. And anyone heading up to Traverse City, once the snow melts, stop by and see them because they have quite the operation there. Thanks so much, Robert.
You're welcome. Thank you, Doctor. Yep.
So this concludes Focus with Paul W. Smith today. I'm Dr. Robert Livernois, and I just want to take a moment to thank the entire team here at WJR. But more importantly, I want to recognize my School Talks sponsors, Must Construction Careers, O'Reilly Rancilio, Collins & Blaha, Wakely & Associates Architects, Clark Construction, and Plant Moran Real Point. And with that, I'm signing off as your host today. It's been a privilege to sit high atop.